Without culture and the relative freedom it implies, society, even when perfect, is but a jungle. This is why any authentic creation is a gift to the future. Albert Camus. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I'm your host. I'd like to thank everyone for joining me this week. I appreciate the support. If you're a newcomer, welcome. I hope you will enjoy this episode and will avail yourself of our backlog. And returning listeners, as always, thank you guys so much for your continued support. This week, we will be moving into Southeast Asia, specifically mainland Southeast Asia, and talking about the prehistory of the people and region between the years of 6 and 4000 BC, BCE, whichever version you prefer. I think I'm going to cover maritime Southeast Asia as we begin to move into the Australia, New Guinea region, continent, whatever you want to call that little combination of places. Though there may be some overlap in some aspects of human life. And I'll try to point that out if and when those instances appear. In terms of modern countries, that will be covered in this episode. These would include countries like Myanmar, Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam, Thailand, as well as, you know, small slivers of India and China, and also probably a portion of Malaysia, too. Before that, though, I did just want to go ahead and put this out there. This is my second attempt at recording this episode. Audacity had an update over the weekend, or at least since the last time I've used it, and it kind of crashed on me, and I lost about 15 minutes worth of recorded audio. So apologies if I seem a little short-tempered or just kind of frustrated if that kind of comes through an audio, which I don't think it will. But this episode may be slightly shorter because, I need to make sure it gets posted. So this may, instead of being a very large one-parter episode, this might be like two kind of like 20, 25 minute episodes. But we'll just have to wait and see how I feel after recording. So now we need to move on to the focus of this week's episode. As we talked about last season, the Neolithic period begins in Southeast Asia, or began right around 7000 BC, you know, give or take a century or two. And there are a couple of sites that, very small sites, where they found remains of, you know, polished stone tools, microlithic blades, things like that. Things that would kind of, you know, show that there has been a change in at least tool manufacture in the region from what it had been prior. And of course, there were, you know, even before Homo sapiens arrived, this was a region that was occupied by several other Homo sapien species. And it's a very good site for hunting and gathering, which again has been the primary mode of living for most of human existence, or at least Homo sapien existence, and of course hominids before us too. During the period of this season, you do begin to see evidence that the groups living along the Shan Highlands, as well as along the Irrawaddy River, are beginning to practice agriculture. Now, again, there is a question if it's true agriculture, if it's domesticated plants, or if it's a process of them beginning their own horticultural experiments and domesticating, just starting the domestication process. It's hard to say exactly because, again, early domesticated strains greatly resemble wild strains. But this is a region that is rich in quite a lot of plants. Obviously, being a jungle, it has a lot of, parts of it being jungle. And the Irrawaddy River, of course, brings a lot of, water and things like that to keep the land fertile. You've also got the Arakan Mountains in addition to the Shan Highlands. And these have numerous valleys as well that, during periods where the temperature's heating up, you'll get water runoff and things like that from mountains and and that also helps produce a lot of water. But there are crops that are probably, again, that they're experimenting, beginning that process towards domestication. And these are things similar to what we talked about. There are, or they're in the family of things that have already been domesticated in other places. And there are, there's also evidence that rice has been imported into the region as well, probably from the Shan Highlands or down through the Irrawaddy River or the Mekong possibly as well. And then, or any of, basically any of the large rivers in Southeast Asia coming down from what is now China, rice could have come down any one or all of them and then spread to, other nearby river sources. Though you don't see huge settlements, at least in terms of numbers. So this is a process very similar to what we saw in eastern India. And that's probably because there is a lot of jungle and tropical environments, which while they're useful for growing, not necessarily the easiest things to clear out. So you don't really see too large settlements at this point. This is something a little bit slower, but you do see a number of sites pop up. But there appears to be cultural continuity, at least to an extent. Last season, we talked about the Patalin Caves in what is now Myanmar and how they had a lot of red ochre drawings of humans, animals, animal-human hybrids, apparently, or at least humans with the spirits of animals, or at least that's what the depiction tends to be. And this is something that is continued. These sites are continually used, even when you have the arrival of Buddhism much, much later. So these are spiritual sites that, at least at some level, were continuously used throughout the history of the region. And that's probably something, again, that's continuing this season. And I want to go ahead and make a correction right now, because I just realized, listening back, just to kind of make sure the audio was still stable, I mentioned the Arakan Mountains. The Arakan Mountains are actually fairly dry. They have like a rain shadow that kind of make a dry zone. They get very little rain. I think at this earlier period, they do see a little bit more than what they're getting now, or at least what they've been getting in the historical period, though how much more, I can't say. I also think there's a part of Vietnam that gets like some semi-arid due to very weak monsoon activity, or if they have weak monsoons, they don't get very much rainfall. But by and large, it's a very tropical region, a lot of fertility all around. So go ahead and correct myself on that one, because as I was saying, I was like, wait, that doesn't seem 100% correct from what I said earlier. Or for what I was reading earlier in the last recording I did. The rainforests here are actually the second largest on Earth. I think the Amazon rainforest is the only larger rainforest in the planet. So it's a very valuable ecological region. And due to that ecology, you do have some groups who are able to maintain not necessarily isolation, but they are able to be more independent or semi-independent, and they're able to maintain that hunter-gatherer lifestyle in addition to groups who are beginning to practice agriculture. And this is something that we'll see more later. In terms of people living in the region, you do have people who are probably related to the Andaman peoples that we talked about for India. As I mentioned, I believe in the episode last week, groups migrating very along the southern kind of coastlines very probably came in from India, initially a long time ago. And they still main, there are still groups there that have genetic relationships to those people. And some of them, of course, have intermarried with other groups that migrate in later. And that's probably happening at this point, too. You also have groups coming in from the north in what is now China. coming down those rivers again, but mainly through the river valleys. And rivers and sailing and just large-scale trade networks are very important to the region. And you'll see this as we continue to look at this area of the world. Even if a group of people may not be navally inclined in terms of sea travel, they're most likely experienced travelers along the rivers themselves. So even if they don't make it out to the open ocean, they are connected to the ocean through large-scale trade links. And this is something that's happening this season. It's probably been happening far longer than that. And if I know it's happened longer than that. And I think I mentioned it last season, too. But river trade is something that is going to continue well into the modern era. And, of course, up to today. Though I do need to point out that the it's much easier to go downriver than upriver. So that's why, at least in the very early periods, you'll see most of these places have more connectivity with, maritime Southeast Asia. The island nations like Brunei, Borneo, those islands, and India. Now, Vietnam's a little different because they do have areas in the north where it's more of a fertile flatland. And they have contacts with China in the north, but they are also connected in the south to what is now Cambodia, Laos. So they have a easier access to China. Again, it's still possible in those other places. It's just not as easy, so at least early on, you see more influence with things like Buddhism, Hinduism, and later Islam to kind of penetrate these areas. Whereas Vietnam is easier to be influenced and influence China, and we'll talk about some of that stuff, of course, much later. Now, even groups that are practicing agriculture, if it is true agriculture, or just again in that early horticulture stage, they are, of course, still hunting and gathering, in addition to groups that are also just pure hunter and gatherers. But even if they are practicing agriculture, generally speaking, these groups are beginning to kind of develop tools further and kind of suiting them more to their environments. And depending on where groups living, that changes what they're gathering and hunting. You have groups living in kind of these solid, like limestone mountains that are, you know, they're basically hunting small mammals. They are eating escargot, snails. Then you have peoples living along mountains that are well watered, and they have streams, rivers, swamps, lakes, things like that, where they're also having snails, but they're also fishing more than they're hunting. And then you have people living in kind of the valleys that are not mountainous, so you have more earth, certain like more soil and surfaces like that. And in places like that, you'll see people eating nuts, more fruits, vegetables too, but also mushrooms. And of course, they're still eating wild cereals and grains and probably larger mammals. One of those mammals is, of course, wild boar or pig, which the pig is being domesticated during this season. And one of the areas that is leading the domestication of pigs is Southeast Asia, as well as East Asia. But this is probably something that's happening, and I talked about this in the domestication episode of pigs, but this is probably something that's happening in several places kind of in tandem. Pigs are fairly easy to quote-unquote domesticate, but they're also able to very easily revert to being wild. So this is probably something that pigs are probably being domesticated. They're escaping, becoming feral, and then later feral versions are being re-domesticated. And this is something you see all over Asia at this period of time. Also, the chicken is being domesticated at this point. The red jungle fowl, I talked about that in the domestication episodes as well. That's probably happening somewhere in Southeast Asia at the very, kind of towards the very start slash right before the start of this season. So that is also contributing to their diet. So you do have, if not fully domesticated animals at the start of this season, by the end of the season, yes, they do have domesticated animals, and they are domesticating more local varieties of legumes, nuts, fruits, vegetables, all kind of stuff. And then, of course, you also have the importation of rice that's happening as well, because this is coming probably down from the Pearl River. But you probably have a couple of different groups bringing rice in. And then domesticating local stocks as well. So that's something that's happening all over Southeast Asia too. Now, in terms of specific archaeological sites, kind of similar to what we saw in the more tropical areas in India, due to the tropical environment, of course, a lot of stuff is probably degraded. And at least when it comes to some countries, a whole lot of very old archaeological research has not been done. Or if it has been done, they haven't really found anything dating to this period. Now, of course, we did talk about the Padalan Caves. There are some other caves with a lot of Neolithic and prior to that Mesolithic and Paleolithic art that we've talked about before. But that's at least where some countries, I can't find anything specific outside of those mentions. Specifically talking about Myanmar in this case. Now, there has been archaeological work done in Myanmar, but unfortunately, couldn't really find any specific sites in terms of like Neolithic villages or anything like that dating to any time during this season, which due to political reasons doesn't really surprise me too much. But that being said, there has been some work that's been done. It's unfortunate they just, it's hard to find anything in English, and the sources I have found that have been translated in English are very bare bones. They just mentioned that they found, specific artifacts just dating to like 6000 BC. After 6000 BC, you're beginning to see more changes taking place, at least in Myanmar. And this is associated with the upcoming, like a big wave of migration coming down from the north. And this is part of the Proto-Austroasiatic spread, at least in terms of language spread. I'm sure there are other peoples moving into the region too. But you will see a number of peoples that speak some form of an Austroasiatic language. Specifically, I think the big one is going to be the Mon people. But that does not happen this season. There's probably precursors. There probably are early elements of this migration that are happening towards the end of the season. This is part of the reason why we see more agricultural show up, too, towards kind of the start of next season. But this doesn't really kick off prior to, at least at a large scale, doesn't kick off prior to around 3000 BC. So that's kind of going to be more of a focus for next season. But there are several waves of migration that are going to be coming up again next season, at least in the Burma-Myanmar. And this is something other people will be migrating into other parts of Southeast Asia, but Proto-Austroasiatic people will be spreading further in Southeast Asia too. And that's going to be focus, a big part of our focus over the next couple of episodes the next couple of seasons when we talk about the region. I wish I had more kind of specifics to get into when it comes to Myanmar. It seems like a very interesting country, and it does have a lot going on in terms of migration. They have a number of peoples moving into the region you know, for quite a long period of time. They have people coming down from the Tibetan Plateau. You have people coming in from India. Again, you have the Austroasiatic waves coming through. And, of course, other peoples from other parts of Southeast Asia. And it's led to a very diverse kind of history in terms of different kingdoms and cultures. And you have a lot of different states and, like, ethnic groups kind of building up to the region. And, you know, that's caused some problems that we'll, of course, talk about later. And Myanmar is not a very easy country for outsiders to visit unless, you know, you're, I think you have to have, like, government permission. I don't know if they've changed that recently or not, but I would love to have more to talk about at this period for Burma. Unfortunately, it's not much to go on. Now, they do have a lot of, like, very early fossils, like we're talking very, very, very early hominids. But that kind of archaeological work has been done. But again, part of that is due to the environment. It's just hard for, you know, human-made artifacts at the earlier part made of wood and stone to really hold up, which is, again, a disappointment. But we'll have a lot more to talk about this part of the world in the next couple of seasons, thankfully. But we do have some other parts of Southeast Asia that do have a little bit more work that has been done, and we're going to go ahead and move on to just continue moving further east, and we'll talk about a couple of sites in what is now Thailand. One of the big ones, and I mentioned it, I believe, last season, but it is Spirit Cave, which is in the Phang Mapha district in the Mekong Son province in what is now northwestern Thailand. So it's very close to the border of Myanmar, but this site has been occupied since at least 9,000 BC, and it is occupied by hunter-gatherers, specifically hunter-gatherers that used Haubenheian tools, which that was a very big group that we talked about last season. Their kind of tool assemblages have been found all over Southeast Asia. And they, of course, lasted to about 8,000 BC, where after that point, you begin to see various regional differences kind of take over. Now, the Haubenheian, or I should say Spirit Cave, has occupied for about, 9,000 to about 5,500 BC. So we're in the last 500 years of seeing this cave actively used during the start of this season. After that point, you can guess that there's a move away from the kind of mountainous regions, and people are moving closer to rivers and places where crops can be grown. Though, again, there's not really definitive evidence of agriculture until about 4,500. At least being practiced at a large scale in this part of Vietnam. But it is probably making its way through the region. And again, Spirit Cave wasn't occupied all the time. It's kind of like a seasonal or semi-seasonal spot. But you do have a very nice view of the Spirit Cave to the Salween River, which is one of the big rivers in the region. And again, a pretty good place to practice agriculture if you are so inclined. Though you do have to worry about floods and things like that, especially with monsoons when those come through. But a very important site in Vietnam that, again, dates back to even before this season begins. Now, there are a couple of other cave sites. There's the Long Cam Nan Cave. Now, this one is a little bit, I don't think it's occupied as late as Spirit Cave was, but there is some debate on that. There are some people that say that it was occupied up until like 2000. But then there are some people that say, no, that's way too late for people to be using it as a hunter-gatherer shelter. But I can't say one way or the other. I'm not a specialist in archaeology. But it is possible that this is also, still being used during this season's period. But it is a seasonal site as well. It's not something that would be occupied for year-round. Now, the other site is known as Wang Bodhi, and this is in the Saiyak district of the Kanchanaburi province in western Thailand, and it's occupied right around 4500 BC, and it will continue to see use for about 1500 years, so right around 3000 BC, which is again a period when you see a lot of migrations into the region. So, this is another one of those transitional sites between hunter gatherers and people beginning to make that ultimate jump to agriculture and sedentarism. And I believe this site is now in a national park. I think there's like three or four national parks kind of all in a row. And they're right on the border between Thailand and Myanmar near the, it's Lake Sinakaran. I'm not sure how it's pronounced. Or Sinakaran. There's quite a few national parks in that region, and I think there's like a very famous waterfall not too far from the from that site, which it may have been one of the draws to the region. Then you also have Banxiang, which is in the Nong Han district in the Udon Thani province, and it is also occupied right around 4500 BC. It doesn't last quite as long as Wang Bodhi, but it's 1,000 years. It's not quite as long, but this is important because it is eventually reoccupied during the Iron Age. And when they were excavating the site, they found several graves, and the oldest ones had no iron, they had no bronze, and they just had stone tools, and then they dig a little digging, and they were able to determine weight. So this site was in use, for about 1,000 years, it was abandoned, and then, a couple millennia later, it's a site for an Iron Age village. So, basically, it's kind of like it's a very good marker for the region in terms of dating everything. Yeah, so it was very helpful for that. So those are kind of the big prehistoric sites that I was able to find something on. Now there are some controversies with this site, but it kind of has to do with some later stuff. But I did want to go ahead and bring them up because it is potentially, very groundbreaking discovery. So there are some people who claim that Thailand was the kind of the site of the earliest bronze or tin bronze in the world. There are claims in some cases that very early mixtures of tin and bronze were done in Thailand around 4000 BC. And we do know that around 2100, 2200, they do enter the Bronze Age in Thailand, or at least they have access to bronze. I haven't done too much on studying their metallurgy, but I have a feeling that they're probably producing their own. So, this might be a case of very early independent discovery of metallurgy, or it's a case of very early importation of bronze work, either from China or India. I'm gonna guess they probably maybe discovered it independently. Again, I have to kind of be able to view a little bit more of the more recent research. But that is found initially, I believe, at Ban Chiang as well. At least that's kind of where they have like the oldest bronze artifacts. And those are dated reliably to 2100. But again, there is evidence, or at least people claim that the evidence that's found has been pointing that they're working with bronze even earlier than that. And I definitely think they're probably working with copper earlier than that. And they may even be making like copper beads or something along those lines. But I wouldn't put it at 5,000 or 4,500. I'm guessing probably sometime towards the start of next season at the earliest. But it's still a very early instance of copper or metallurgy in Southeast Asia. So just make of that what you will. But I'll have more to say on that once I'm able to really dive into those later sources. All right. And yeah, so that's kind of the highlights for Thailand and Myanmar, such as those highlights were. We broke 30 minutes, which is better than I was expecting. Sorry, this was kind of a rougher episode. I had those audio issues. But this is kind of a good overview. We'll be back next week when we talk about the other sites in Southeast Asia in what are different countries today, places like Cambodia, Laos, Vietnam. We'll also go into more detail on some of the regional variations that arose from the Halbanian culture. That episode is still very popular, at least on YouTube. It's got over 200 views there, and I still see it in my like regularly downloaded episodes on the audio feeds too. So it's a pretty popular one, and I hope you guys have enjoyed this one. Please like, subscribe, all that kind of good stuff. If you've got any questions, comments, constructive criticism, if I did not make any sense at certain points and you need me to clarify something I was saying, please let me know. I know this was a kind of a rougher episode, but you can reach out to me via email at waradrevpod@gmail.com. You can contact me via direct message on Twitter/X, or you can comment on the YouTube videos. I would appreciate that too. I try to respond as quickly as I can there. And if you're subscribed on YouTube, you can drop in if I'm live streaming. I play historical games, things like that. Thank you all for joining me. And I hope you will enjoy this episode. And I hope you have a good rest of your day and week, kind of from whenever you're listening to this. And I hope I'll see you all next time. Peace.